today, we discuss a disaster in the Australian outback where searing heat, severe drought and terrible mismanagement has allowed rivers to run dry. And, in opinion, The Guardian Zoe Williams asks if we're all a bit too hysterical about screen time. Southern Australia is in the middle of an extraordinary heatwave, with temperatures soaring to up to 47 degrees.
A heatwave that is sweeping right across central and southeastern Australia today. Temperature records
southwest, and the mercury was only headed one way.
It's happening when the country is already in one of the worst droughts in its recorded history.
It's drying out the landscape. It's really starting to dry.
In large parts of the Murray-Darling Basin, a huge swathe of land the size of Egypt, little rain is expected for months.
It's like the main artery in Australia. So people are starting to really worry about what the future holds.
The area's drying rivers that run from Queensland through New South Wales, Victoria and into South Australia are increasingly the site of fish kills.
Mass fish deaths are now being reported all over the Murray-Darling Basin.
This morning we're just getting reports coming through of a fish kill down at Lake Hume.
The latest, this week, saw the water carpeted with hundreds of thousands of bony bream, golden perch and Murray cod.
It's an absolute catastrophe. This magnificent animal must be generations old and now is dead.
And local residents fear being forced to abandon their homes in search of clean water.
No animals, no animal habitat, no water to swim, cook, wash with anymore.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, a disaster in the Australian outback.
So we flew about 3.5 hours to Mildura, which is near the junction of the Murray and the Darling rivers, down on the border of South Australia and Victoria and New South Wales.
And then Anne Davies, who reports The Guardian Australia, travelled to the Menindee Lakes along with a photographer.
We drove about 3 to 4 hours up a dirt road, but it's really quite remote, and particularly at this time of year because the temperature was 47 degrees Celsius.
What does that feel like?
It feels like you're in an oven. You walk out and as the wind blows, it feels like it's just scorching your legs. I've never felt anything like it.
Yeah, it's quite. It's almost a claustrophobic heat that closes in on you when you're around it, and getting back into the.
And then you start getting a little bit dizzy, tired. You start sweating.
47 degrees. I mean, that's not normal, is it?
Look, around that part of the world, you can have 47 degrees one or two days a year. But people are getting really, really worried that we're getting like 2 weeks of this temperature in a row. So we drove up to Menindee, which used to be quite a big tourist spot. There was some agriculture, including grape growing and citrus. But now all the grapes have been abandoned. And so there's just these skeletal grape vines everywhere in fields, and then further up it'll just be a dry riverbed.
Why did you go to this area?
So the reason why we went to Menindee was on January 7 there was a major fish kill, and by that I mean all these fish just suddenly died and floated to the surface. There was a carpet of these little fish, and in amongst them were larger, quite endangered fish, the golden perch and the silver perch, and also some very large Murray cod, which are a native fish that can grow up to a metre long and be 60, 70 years old. We've had photos coming back from Menindee of the river literally carpeted with these tiny little white, silvery fish. It's really disturbing. We went down to the edge of the Darling River. Most people tell me you would never see a Murray cod in your life, but there they were. They were just gasping for breath, and it was quite horrifying to see. We saw one just turn over and flip a few times and it died right in front of us.
So how many fish have died?
So we've had three fish kills in Menindee. All of them have been, first one were tens of thousands, and then two that people say are in the hundreds of thousands. I think we're going to end up with a figure that's probably, you know, a million fish have died in the river in the last month. People say that the bony bream, the ones that are dying in the hundreds of thousands, they're really important in the food chain in the river. And without them, we're going to see impacts all the way through right down to South Australia.
And some of the fish you're talking about are enormous Murray cod. I mean, they weigh 62 kilograms. It's the weight of a person. And in pictures, people have their arms stretched out wide to hold onto them. They're huge, aren't they?
Yes, they're really large. And the people in Menindee have this relationship with the fish. You know, they love them. And, you know, it's been part of their tourism industry. It's part of their, you know, the mythology of the old timers about the fish they've caught. And they've, you know, I've seen grown men weeping over these dead fish.
I can't put any words to it. It's just very, very sad, very sad.
Disgrace. This is a man-made disaster. Look at these animals.
Look at them. That makes me feel like crying again.
Why are they dying?
Well, the preliminary investigation has suggested that it's caused by high temperatures and then low temperatures that follow. And because there's no flow in the river, the water has been becoming slowly deoxygenated by blue-green algae, which is a poisonous algae. And then when the temperature falls, the algae dies and uses up more oxygen, leaving the fish without any dissolved oxygen in the water.
Why is there a lack of water? Is it all because of the drought?
So the issue for Australia with this river system is that it's been historically, farming has just been able to take water out of the river system, and gradually it's become unsustainable. Now, the government realised this in the 2000s when we had another drought, and they've been endeavouring to come up with a plan to manage the water better. But what this has exposed is that, you know, there's just way too much water being taken out still. And the government has perhaps bowed to big agriculture at the expense of the environment.
And just to be clear, what kind of agriculture are we talking about?
So in some of the driest parts of Australia, we now grow cotton, almonds, citrus, and these crops all require huge amounts of water. As the government has tried to regulate how much water is used by agriculture, the result has been that big agriculture has bought up a lot of the water rights. Australians often say, why are we growing cotton in such a dry climate? And the answer is, well, it makes money.
And it's worth saying that cotton farmers have said they feel they've been unfairly blamed for what's happening. And you visited some other farms. Who did you meet?
So we visited one of these farms in what's called the Lower Darling. It's a massive property of 500,000 hectares. It's one of the biggest sheep stations in New South Wales. But, you know, Lauren, who's the wife of the manager, is absolutely struggling to know whether she can stay there.
But even before the heat came, we've sort of been struggling to cope with the lack of water. So for a long time now, we always knew the river was going to be dry.
She's got a little baby who's 7 months old called Will. They would usually just drink the river water, use it for their stock. When it has blue-green algae in it, that's not an option.
The smell is unbelievable. It's unbearable.
What does it smell like?
It smells like poo. It smells like rotten eggs. It's just, you can't fill up a sink to do the dishes because it's just awful. We usually brush our teeth in this water. We usually bathe.
She can't actually bath her child in the river water. The river water's been declared, it's got a red alert for blue-green algae, and the medical advice is don't touch it, don't drink it, don't swim in it. She's even wondering whether she can wash her floors with it because the baby will be on the floor.
Well, the last time it went dry, some of the kids in Pooncarie and other stations got very, very sick. They had, like, bad sores on them just from playing in the sprinklers, etc., and they were on, like, antibiotics for months afterwards.
So instead, they're bathing the baby in a tiny little amount of rainwater. They've now run out of rainwater, so they're going to get water trucked in from somewhere else.
It's not fair. It makes you angry, makes you sad, and it just feels like nobody cares about you.
When you were watching her, how did you feel?
It was just so hot. I felt for her. You know, I could see how worried she was about the baby.
Yeah, every day we think about leaving. Like, is it worth it being here? Like, this is our home. We love it so much, but is it worth it? What if Will does get sick from the water?
Lorena, where's your family from?
We're Yawarrari people, so we're river people from the far northwest of New South Wales. My grandmother was born on the Narran River, which is on the northwest edge of the Murray-Darling Basin.
Lorena Allam is the Guardian's Indigenous Affairs editor. She spent a lot of her childhood on the banks of the river, visiting her family who have lived there for decades. Recently, she travelled back to the region to see the impact of the drought.
For Yawarrari people, the river is very important culturally. We share that water with all the other nations of the basins. There's about 46 different nations in the Murray-Darling Basin, but they all believe they have a strong responsibility to look after not just the country, but the water.
Are the communities that live by the river predominantly Indigenous communities?
Yes, absolutely. So most of the little towns along the Murray-Darling are majority Indigenous population because that's where people were herded onto reserves at the turn of the century after they were sort of brought in from their traditional lands. But they have lived on these rivers since before Europeans arrived.
Tell me about that trip.
Because I hadn't been home, so to speak, for a long time, but the rivers are just always there. So it was a shock to me to see how degraded the country was, to see these big rivers empty and those enormous old gum trees on the riverbanks that really give you shelter and peace when you sit by the river. To see those big old trees sort of falling into the empty riverbed was quite confronting.
Do you have memories of visiting your family as a child? And in those memories, what did the river mean?
The rivers sustained us culturally, physically, spiritually, for centuries. That's where we ate, that's where we had ceremonies, that's where babies were born, that's where funeral practices were carried out.
And were they reliant on the water for their livelihoods?
In those mission times, people called them, when Aboriginal people during the protection era in the last century were herded onto reserves and lived on rations, flour, sugar and tea, a lot of people were hungry and a lot of people were poor. So the rivers even then provided sustenance. So you could always go and catch a fish or a yabby. Do you know what a yabby is?
No.
It's a freshwater crayfish, which tastes divine. It's like a lobster, but less salty.
Do you remember seeing people catching yabbies when you were a kid?
Absolutely. You go down to the river, start a little fire and boil a can of water, and you could cook your fish and yabbies. And so it was a rich life on the river.
And you returned recently and the river was gone. How do people feel about what's happening?
Well, not just one river, all of them. So we travelled at a four-hour one-way drive. There were no rivers at all. The Barwon is dry, the Namoi is dry. The Great Narran Lakes, which are heritage-protected wetlands, are dry. And the elders out there were crying and telling us, you know, these are 80-year-old people who have gone through all sorts of deprivations in their long lives, who've never seen the river this bad. Virginia Robinson, one of our elders, said,
"This to me is the ultimate destruction of our culture. All people think about now is there's no water in the river because they were in harmony with nature. That's all unbalanced, all destroyed now."
And do you believe that when the government is thinking about this crisis, it's thinking about those communities?
No. The Barwon River at Walgett and the Darling River at Wilcannia, the two towns in the system that have the biggest Aboriginal populations, the number of times the river stopped flowing was in the last decade was phenomenal. It's obvious that these towns are, you know, being abandoned in a way. They're being neglected. The government's strong view, as the water minister said to me the other day, is that this is caused by drought. They're saying that it's unavoidable and that when it rains, everything will be fine. But I know that people don't buy that for a minute. They see cotton farms upstream that have plenty of water for irrigation and they start to wonder why it is that they have to subsist on bore water and there's no running water coming down their rivers.
It's like a triple whammy. Drought, clearing trees, climate change, no water.
What role do upcoming elections play?
So climate change has been an issue in Australia for quite a while now, but we have a federal government that is absolutely opposed to admitting that it exists. Our current Prime Minister brought a lump of coal into Parliament. The previous Prime Minister was famously quoted as saying climate change is crap. But the sight of all those dead fish, the sight of, you know, little children bathing in brown, muddy water that's coming from the tap, I hope is going to galvanise people in a way that we haven't before. And there are enough people in the constituencies of those MPs whose seats are now looking very shaky indeed because their voter heartland are turning against them because of what they're seeing happening to their beloved rivers. And I think the current government is on borrowed time.
This week, the state politician who's responsible for water in New South Wales travelled to the Lower Darling River to witness the third mass fish death this month. Speaking on the banks of the river, Niall Blair admitted, "We've seen nothing like this," and acknowledged it was about more than the drought.
And that's why I'm here, okay? Yeah. So I'm not downplaying this. This is something, right, that warrants the prompt attention of the government.
Anne Davies has been reporting on a plan for the area, which has been in place since 2007. But many say it's not enough.
The Murray-Darling Basin Plan is probably their best attempt at trying to resolve the conflicts between the environment and farmers and irrigation and climate change. So the plan is the government put $13 billion, that's about £7 billion, aside to buy back water for the environment. The trouble is it's not going to be enough to turn the river back into a sustainable system.
Do you think the government has taken the side of big business over the side of local communities?
Well, since 2013, we've had a Conservative government in Australia, including the National Party, which is a coalition partner. Now, they're the party of the bush, of farmers, with the result that I think farmers have had a far louder voice than environmental groups, and certainly the science has been ignored.
And are farmers starting to change their mind?
Well, yes, I think that's what's happening. So there's certainly a group of farmers who are now realising that unless the plan is revisited, there could be an environmental disaster in the future.
You went to meet one of these farmers who'd already become famous for speaking up about this. What did he do?
So Rob McBride and one of his mates waded into the river and picked up two large cod and filmed themselves saying how horrified they were.
And look at these iconic fish of Australia being treated like this. You have to be bloody disgusted with yourself.
It's absolutely gone viral. And I think single-handedly they've put the problems of the river onto the world stage.
This is nothing to do with drought. No. This is a man-made disaster.
We went down to Rob McBride's property and his family have been there since the 40s and they have one of the biggest sheep stations in New South Wales. But they're not big water users and they're in a part of the river which is just becoming more and more dry.
This is the Murray-Darling. This is the most amazing river system.
I can see in his face just desperation about what's going to happen to his property.
Look, clearly the big boys' view is destroy the Menindee Lakes. We're just sacrificial lambs out here to justify...
A lot of it feels like maybe this is teetering on the edge of an ecological disaster and that this part of Australia is on the kind of front line of climate change?
Well, the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, I know this will come as a surprise, does not actually take into account climate change. So when they devised it, they used all the numbers that were based on the last 100 years, even though they had work done by our leading scientists, which said you can't rely on the same sort of water flows. You have to look forward into the future where it's likely we'll see hotter, drier climates in the south. You need to adjust the plan accordingly. Now, that hasn't been done.
If it sounds like urgent action is needed, what needs to be done?
So we've recently had an inquiry and we had a parade of scientists who came to give evidence, and they said you need to allocate more water to the environment or this plan will fail.
So Lorena, what might happen? Are people going to survive in this area?
Well, it's a good question. Bourke, for example, in western New South Wales, has just had its 21st day of above 40 degree temperatures with severe water restrictions and no water in the river. So we're dealing with communities that are, you know, quite precarious now. The people of Walgett told us, black and white alike, said, we've got 6 months if we don't get some water.
That was Lorena Allam and Anne Davies. Do read all of their reporting on the Murray-Darling crisis and have a look at some of the astonishing photographs at theguardian.com. Coming up, is it time for parents to calm down about the amount of time their children spend staring at screens?
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Now, Guardian columnist Zoe Williams on the screen time debate.
So my son, who's 11, watches people playing games that he also plays, and often he'll have two screens going. So he'll be playing Fortnite on one screen, and then he'll have an iPad in front of him on which, like, a 17-year-old from Utah is also playing Fortnite. But they're not playing the same game. One of my daughters watches these horrible, horrible kind of crude animations of, you know, girls with Barbie figures saying mean things to each other. Then my other daughter watches kind of crafters and people making slime, people melting stuff. Watching her watch it is kind of, this is really pointless and boring, but it's actually made her much more crafty and into melting things. Now, you know, but there will be people listening to that who are like, this is an absolutely horrible dystopian childhood because they're not reading or doing embroidery or helping me cook. None of them can cook. I could use to be a bit stricter, but I suppose I'm unwilling to interrupt too much what they actually want to do. There's a huge amount of childhood which is not what you want to do. You don't want to go to school. You generally don't want to go swimming. So, you know, I've got to be honest, I probably do let them do whatever they like in the time that they've got available. There are things about the internet which are bad, which parents do worry about, and they worry about with reason. So there is anxiety about online bullying. It does seem to be more pernicious and a bit more savage. There is that element where, you know, your Instagram self becomes your entire self, and then a lot of social anxiety attaches to that because a simple thumbs down from a stranger can ruin your day. I don't know any of my children's PIN numbers, and I wouldn't ask them. The orthodoxy is so fixed, you should have the PIN numbers to all your children's devices and you should feel free to go through them, because otherwise how do you know what they're up to, who they're talking to, that they're not communicating with a paedophile, that they're not bullying someone else, that nobody's bullying them. And I just would not be willing to do that because I think it kind of fosters an atmosphere of mistrust and dishonesty. I think a kid, a moderately intelligent child of 11, can outwit you if they want to. So there's no point looming over them because they'll find a way to have privacy, even if you don't give it to them. And really, if you want to protect them from the dangerous things that the world can throw at them, the kind of number one thing in that is that they feel like they can talk to you, which they won't feel like if you've set up this dynamic. But you know, I've said that in front of kind of parenting panels and stuff, and people look at me like I'm absolutely crazy. On the one hand, you've got this kind of culture of perfection around parenthood, and then on the other hand, you've got this culture of productivity around childhood. So children are meant to be always doing something productive, always improving themselves, always maximizing their time. I really don't like it. I think it makes them very anxious. I think there are kind of lived realities of human life which cannot be measured and cannot be maximized. And I'm really uncomfortable with the idea of like packing every second of their days with yet more stuff. There are kind of elements of the internet that make me anxious, but I certainly would take that anxiety over something more profound about kind of controlling their every waking moment.
That's all for today. My thanks to Anne Davies, Lorena Allam, and Zoe Williams. This episode was produced by India Rakerson, Amar Kalia, and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll see you next week.